their school principal. The portly man's uniform was muddy and torn, and he hugged a tall canvas sack to his chest. Principal Kojima cried out in surprise as the boys all popped up screaming and brandishing grenades, and he tripped over his own feet and fell to the ground. The sack broke his fall, but something inside it shattered and snapped. Framed pictures spilled out onto the forest floor.
No! No!
The principal cried.
Principal Kojima?
Hideki said. Luckily, none of the boys had activated their grenades, and now they all hurried to help their principal to his feet.
The Emperor! The pictures of the Emperor!
Kojima said.
Some of them have been damaged!
Hideki picked up one of the framed photographs that was still intact. It was a picture of Emperor Hirohito. A portrait of the Emperor hung in every room at school. Hideki and the other boys had to bow to the picture and the Japanese flag every time they came or went. Principal Kojima must have collected every one of the portraits and stuffed them into this sack. Principal Kojima scrambled to collect the other pictures.
"It is my sacred duty to protect the Divine Emperor's photographs," he said. "I'm taking these north to the Imperial Photograph Guardian Unit. The Emperor's spirit must be protected."
Hideki had never seen Principal Kojima so frantic, and it scared him a little. He could tell the other boys were frightened too, but Hideki understood the principal's concern. A person's spirit, what the Okinawans called mabui, was like his soul. It's what made you who you were. Everybody had a mabui, including Hideki. A mabui was immortal and transferable. A ring you inherited from your grandmother might have her mabui in it. A watch your father had owned might still carry his mabui. You could even lose your mabui if you weren't careful. In pictures, whether they were drawings or photographs like these of Emperor Hirohito, they carried part of a person's mabui in them too. So, it was like each of these photos was a little piece of the Emperor's soul. It was the mabui of Hideki's cowardly ancestor, Shigetomo Kaneshiro, that still cursed every third generation of Hideki's family. Hideki's own mabui shared space inside him with the spirit of Shigetomo. As long as Shigetomo's spirit was still restless, Hideki would never know peace and could never truly be himself. Hideki's sister had tried to help him with Shigetomo's mabui in her official role as a Yuta, but Kimiko had always had more success with other people. Once, Hideki remembered, he had gone with her on a house call to a family with a young boy who kept getting in trouble at school. That day, Kimiko had worn a white bashofu, a lightweight banana fiber kimono that matched the streak in her hair.
"Shinsei keeps getting into fights," the boy's mother had complained. "I have to bring him home at least once a week. His older brother, Ichiro, never got into trouble like this."
Shinsei was a scruffy, surly boy of 7 with a thin trickle of snot running down his dirty face. Hideki thought he looked like trouble, but Kimiko smiled at the boy and talked to him like an adult.
"Have you been having bad dreams, Shinsei?"
she asked him. Shinsei frowned and looked away. In the next room, a baby cried, and Shinsei's mother got up to see it.
"Shinsei?"
Kimiko tried again.
"Yes,"
the boy grunted.
"A female wolf comes and chases me out of the house and won't let me back in."
"I think I understand," Kimiko said.
"You do?"
Shinsei asked.
"You do?"
Hideki asked. He was confused. None of it made any sense to him.
"The wolf in Shinsei's dream represents a female ancestor born in the year of the dog," Kimiko explained.
When Shinsei's mother came back, Kimiko asked her if there was someone matching that description who had been a troublemaker in the past.
"Yes, my Aunt Toshi," the mother said. "My mother's middle sister. She was always running around with boys my grandfather didn't like. Oh, the fights they would have."
Kimiko nodded.
"Shinsei has his great Aunt Toshi's mabui on him. She's still acting out through him. Go once a week to the family tomb where she is buried, just the two of you, and perform the ceremony I teach you." "You got all that from his dream about a wolf?"
Hideki asked later as he and Kimiko walked home. Kimiko grinned.
Well, not all of it. Being a Yuta is about listening to our ancestors. But it's about paying attention to the living, too. Did you hear the cries from the other room? There's a new baby in the house. And his mother mentioned an older brother, which makes Shinsei the middle child. The oldest brother has all the responsibility, and the baby gets all the mother's attention. Shinsei doesn't have a role in the family anymore, so he acts out to get any kind of attention, even if it's negative attention. He probably doesn't even know he's doing it. But now he and his mother will spend time together once a week, walking back and forth to the family tomb to perform a ceremony together. And Shinsei will get lots of attention without having to get into trouble. So, all that about his great aunt Toshi, you just made that up?
Hideki asked. Kimiko smacked him on the head.
No! Her Mabui really is on him. She was a middle child too, didn't you hear? She probably went through the same thing, only there was no Yuta to send her on long walks to the family tomb with her mother, so she never got over it.
Kimiko's voice grew quiet.
I hope Shinsei's trips to the family tomb with his mother will bring both him and his great aunt Toshi peace in the end.
Hideki still had trouble understanding it all, but his sister seemed to know what she was talking about.
I'm a middle child, too, and I never acted like that, he said at last.
That's because you have a different Mabui to worry about,
Kimiko told him, one Hideki would have to wait a little longer to appease.
I've got to get these pictures to safety,
Principal Kojima was saying now. Hideki watched as he stuffed the last of the Emperor's portraits back in the bag and stood up.
Remember to fight and die for your country with honor. We'll meet again in the afterlife,
he told his former students, and ran off. The boys were debating whether to return to the cave or to keep looking for American soldiers when Yoshio perked up.
Do you smell that?
He whispered. A delicious aroma tickled Hideki's nose, and he turned into the wind and sniffed. Somebody nearby was cooking something over a campfire. Something good. Hideki hadn't eaten meat in ages. All the meat in Okinawa now went to the Japanese soldiers, and his mouth watered at the tasty smell. Some of the other boys had picked up on it too, and they smiled at each other. Hideki's stomach growled eagerly, but he didn't smile. The smell of roasting meat could mean only one thing.
Americans,
he whispered.
Ray. Barbecue. Ray sat apart from the other Marines, watching them laugh and talk as they ate barbecued pig. His squad had met up with the rest of Easy Company, strength in numbers as they set up camp for the night. From the safety of their foxholes, they were all sharing in the feast Ray had prepared. He was the man of the hour, but he didn't feel much like celebrating. He'd just watched Billy Lineker get shot in front of him. So had the other men in Ray's squad. How could they be joking and enjoying barbecue just a few hours later? Sergeant Meredith sat down on the edge of Ray's foxhole.
You did good today, Sergeant Meredith said. Flushing that sniper out?
Flushing that 12-year-old boy out, Ray thought. That little kid.
You okay with it?
The sergeant asked. The sniper? I guess, Ray said. As surprising as it was that the sniper was just a kid, Ray understood why they had to kill him. This was a war. It was kill or be killed, and the kid had killed one of theirs. But the way Big John had done it, so easily, so casually. But that wasn't even what was bothering him the most about that day.
And hard luck, Sergeant Meredith said, as though he could read Ray's mind. Ray huffed.
I don't understand. He raised his chin at the other men.
Don't they care? They do care, yes, said the sergeant. So do I. But it's fate. Either you have a bullet or a mortar or a grenade with your name on it or you don't. That bullet finds you and we mourn, but we have to move on. Nothing else we can do.
But it just seems so heartless, Ray said.
It is, Sergeant Meredith allowed. But Marines like me and Big John and the old man, this ain't our first rodeo. We've seen a lot of good men die. If we mourned every one of them the way they should be mourned, we'd go crazy.
The sergeant rubbed a callus on his palm, the same place Ray's rifle had given him blisters during basic training.
We had to let our skins harden up so we don't feel it as much. We can't, or it'd hurt too bad. You ever see a guy with that thousand-yard stare? You know what's getting to him.
Ray had seen that stare before in his father's eyes, like he was focused on something a long way off that nobody else could see. Ray knew that's when his pa had been remembering his time in the First World War. Over in his foxhole, the old man was doing it now.
Starks, grab me a hunk of that pig, will you?
Sergeant Meredith called to him. The old man shook himself out of the stare and grinned.
Sure, Sergeant.
Sergeant Meredith glanced at Ray, and Ray understood. Their lieutenant found them and told Sergeant Meredith that scouts had reported a possible enemy cave nearby.
Send a team to check it out while we've still got some daylight, the lieutenant said.
The sergeant saluted and called Big John over.
Big John, take Gonzalez and Barbecue here and a couple of the other rookies and show them the ropes.
And just like that, Ray had a nickname, Barbecue. The cave was a quarter of a mile away from camp, very close to a steep cliff that ran a long way down to the sea, where waves crashed against big rocks. It was a natural cavern, with rock walls and a dirt floor. The entrance was about half as tall as Ray and overgrown with moss. It was pitch black, just a foot or two inside. There was no telling how far it went back into the hillside, or if anybody was hiding inside.
Is someone going in there? Gonzalez asked. You kidding?
Big John said.
We're gonna flush him out. Rifle's ready.
Big John took a grenade from his belt, pulled the pin, and chucked it inside. Ray raised his rifle to his shoulder and aimed at the entrance.
Thoom!
The explosion shook the ground, and smoke billowed out from the entrance. Inside, there were screams. Ray's heart raced, and he shuffled his feet nervously. Suddenly, people came streaming out from the cave, and Ray's fingers tightened on the trigger. But it was a woman, holding a baby, and the next target Ray swung to was a little boy, then an old man.
Wait, wait! Ray cried. They're Okinawans! Civilians!
The Okinawans kept coming. 10, 15, 20, Ray lost count. He watched as the people ran away screaming from the Marines. They went straight for the edge of the cliff and raced back and forth along the edge of it, looking down like they were trying to find some path to escape. But Ray and the other Marines had walked along that ridge to get here. It was just a long fall into rocks and trees. The grenade going off must have spooked them, Ray thought. He fished out his Japanese phrase book and tried to find something that would calm them down.
Hidoi koto washimasen,
he tried, walking closer.
We're not going to hurt you, he said in English.
The women and children wailed as Ray got closer, sobbing like it was the end of the world, and Ray wondered if he was saying it wrong. Then the whole lot of them stepped off the cliff. Ray blinked, and his stomach dropped. One second they had been huddled there in fear, and the next moment, they were just gone.
No,
Ray cried. There was no way they could have survived the fall.
Jumpin' Jehoshaphat,
Big John whispered.
Why in the name of God would they do that?
Gonzalez asked. None of them had the answer. Ray double-checked his phrase book. He hadn't said anything wrong, but for some reason the Okinawans had been so terrified of him and the other Marines that they had killed themselves rather than be captured.
Well, better that than one of them coming out with a grenade and trying to blow us up, Big John said. Let's make sure there ain't any more of them in there, and then get back and get us some more of that pig before it's gone.
Ray followed Big John into the cave, but he wouldn't be eating any more barbecue tonight. Ray had lost his appetite.
Hideki. Banzai. Hideki and the other boys crept toward the delicious smell, and sure enough, there they were. American soldiers. There were almost 20 of them, sitting around a cook fire or in holes they had dug in the ground. Some of them wrote letters or cleaned their guns. Others were eating a pig they'd cooked up. Hideki could hear their voices on the breeze, the long, slow, deep, slurred sounds of English that made no sense to him. None of the soldiers had seen or heard them yet, which meant the Blood and Iron Student Corps had the element of surprise. This really was Hideki's moment of glory, but he wasn't feeling so bold anymore. This was going to be a violent battle. This might be the moment he died. One of the other boys, Takashi, must have been thinking the same thing too. Hideki could see him sobbing quietly a few meters away. Shigatomo's Mabui tugged at Hideki's gut, and Hideki took a step back.
"Here's what we'll do," Yoshio whispered at Hideki's side, making him jump. "We'll crawl closer, and then, when we're all in range, I'll whistle, and kathoom!"
A grenade exploded close enough to knock them over, and Hideki's ears rang from the explosion.
What happened?"
he asked as he pulled himself back up on his knees.
"Takashi killed himself! He blew himself up with his own grenade!"
one of the boys yelled in horror. Was it an accident? Or had Takashi killed himself out of fear? Hideki was still gaping, still trying to understand, when he heard the American soldiers cry out in alarm. The element of surprise was gone. The Americans were going for their guns. They would be on top of Hideki and the others in seconds.
"Attack! Attack!"
Yoshio cried. He pulled the pin on his grenade, whacked the brass igniter on a rock, and hurled the grenade. It went off with a boom a few meters away. Hideki couldn't see what Yoshio had hit, because a second later the bullets started flying.
Pack, 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 pack. Choo, 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 choo.
Hideki barely had room to curl up and hide behind a shredded tree stump. He watched as a fifth year named Gensei couldn't get to cover in time. Gensei was hit again and again by bullets, his body dancing like a broken puppet before he crumpled to the ground. Hideki had never seen somebody die before. His own body shook uncontrollably, like he was the one being hit, and tears sprang to his eyes.
"Banzai!"
some of the boys cried, and Hideki heard one or two more grenades explode. The American bullets became a deadly hailstorm, and Hideki clenched himself into a tight, shaking ball. He looked at the grenade he held in his hand. He knew he should be brave. He knew he should stand up and throw his grenade and kill as many Americans as he could, the way Lieutenant Colonel Sano had told him to. But he couldn't do it. His fear froze him. He couldn't move. Off to his right, his friend Katsumasa stood, grenade in hand.
"Long live the Emperor!"
he cried. Katsumasa threw his grenade with all his strength. The grenade hit a tree, bounced right back at Katsumasa, and exploded in his face with a boom. The blast knocked Hideki from his hiding place, and he landed on his back with a thump that knocked the wind from him. He gasped for air and swallowed a scream. This was a disaster. It wasn't supposed to go like this. This wasn't what it had been like in training. It was all happening so fast, and they had no control over any of it. Hideki was going to die here. They were all going to die here. His eyes darted around, looking for somewhere to hide, but all he saw was the decimated hillside. Less than half a dozen of the boys were still alive and fighting. The rest had been shot or blown apart. And if he didn't get out of here, Hideki was going to join them.
Ray. First Watch. Ray leaned on his entrenching tool and stretched his sore back. He'd spent the last half hour digging a 4-foot-deep foxhole with Big John that both of them would sleep in that night. If he'd thought shoveling hay back home was hard, it was nothing compared to shoveling sand and coral on Okinawa. Was this what it was like for my father in the First World War? Ray thought. That war had been all trenches and foxholes, where his father's arms and back sore every night from digging endless ditches. When the hole was finished, Ray wanted nothing more than to pass out in it and sleep until next week, but no such luck.
"Barbecue," the sergeant called. "You've got guard duty first watch. Be careful. While you two were off clearing caves, we were attacked by a bunch of kids with grenades.
Ray had heard the sound of shots and explosions in the distance as they'd been returning from the cave. He shook his head. Women and children throwing themselves off a cliff? Children with grenades? This definitely wasn't what he signed up for.
Big John clapped Ray on the shoulder. The fun never stops when you're a Marine. Don't worry, I'll stay up with you for a bit.
Ray sighed and picked up his rifle.
Don't forget this, Big John said, plunking Ray's helmet on his head. That helmet's the best thing the Marine Corps ever gave you, Barbecue. It's got 100 uses.
Really?
Sure, Big John said. You can wash in it, shave in it, cook coffee in it, and barf in it when you get sick. You can put gas in it to clean your gun, dig a hole with it if you lose your entrenching tool, sit on it and use it to bail out your foxhole when it rains. That right there is the greatest military tool ever invented.
Ray reached up to straighten his helmet. You forgot the part about it keeping you from getting shot in the head, he told Big John. Big John snorted.
Oh, it don't do that.
Ray remembered the sniper putting a bullet right through Sergeant Meredith's helmet. That made him think of hard luck again. The look on his face after the bullet hit him, the way he tumbled head first into the mud. Laughing and joking one minute, dead the next. The camp settled into quiet as darkness fell. One man in each foxhole went to sleep while the others, like Ray, watched the surrounding terrain for intruders. But all Ray saw was hard luck, over and over again.
How'd you end up in the Marines, Barbecue?
Big John whispered.
Huh?
Ray said, shaking off the memory of hard luck's death. Had Big John caught him doing the 1,000-yard stare and asked him a question to distract him? It didn't matter. It had worked.
Oh, I graduated from high school and I wasn't going to college, so I enlisted before I got drafted.
He left out the part about the fight he'd had with his father, the awful things Ray had said to him, his mother in tears. Big John nodded.
Me, I never finished 8th grade.
He spoke quietly, just above a whisper, so they could hear any Japanese soldiers approaching.
I was already big enough to work and join a street gang, and that's what I did until I borrowed a car for a joyride, and the cops got wise. Judge gave me a choice, join the Marines or go to juvie. Enlisting sounded a lot better than reform school, and here I am.
Ray couldn't believe Big John hadn't even finished 8th grade, and that he'd been arrested for stealing a car. How many more of Easy Company had crazy stories about how they'd ended up in the Marines? Something rustled in the undergrowth just beyond the camp's perimeter, and Big John put up a hand to tell Ray to be quiet. Ray raised his rifle and squinted in the half-light of the moon.
How'd you make out, Joe?
Asked a quiet voice. The words were English, but the accent was definitely Japanese. Before Ray knew what was happening, Big John opened up with his big Browning automatic. Chung, 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 chung. Ray didn't know what Big John was shooting at until a Japanese soldier popped up right in front of them.
Banzai!
The soldier screamed, charging Ray and Big John. Ray flinched, but pulled his trigger.
Pakow!
And the bullet hit the soldier. He fell to the ground, but he wasn't dead yet. With the strength he still had left, the Japanese soldier raised his rifle in the direction of Big John. In a wild panic, Ray pointed his rifle straight down at the enemy soldier and shot him again.
Pakow!
And at last, the man was still. Ray stood over the soldier, watching the life in his eyes go out. More Marines from Easy Company came running with their rifles, but it was all over as quickly as it had begun. As his adrenaline wore off, Ray started to shake so much he couldn't stand. He staggered back, dropped his rifle, and collapsed inside the foxhole. He couldn't stop the tears that streamed from his eyes, and he turned away, sure Big John was going to make fun of him.
Hey, it's okay, Ray, Big John said softly.
He knelt beside Ray and put a hand on his shoulder.
I know what it feels like to kill a man for the first time,
Big John told him.
We all do.
That just made Ray cry harder. But it felt good to cry, to get it all out, all this sadness and terror and shaking rage he felt about everything he'd seen and done in just a day on Okinawa.
You had to do it, Big John told him. You saved us both.
Ray nodded, running his sleeve across his nose and wiping the tears from his eyes.
It gets easier,
Big John said, and Ray couldn't tell if he meant it as a good thing or a bad thing. Big John stood.
Get your rifle and see if he's got anything on him.
Ray wiped his nose and dried his eyes again, and he stood. Looking at the body of the man he'd killed was easier if he didn't look at his face. Ray collected the soldier's rifle and laid it to his side. Then he went through the man's pockets. In one of them he found a wallet, and inside the wallet was a picture of the soldier and his family. Ray was taken aback for a moment. Here was the face of the man he'd just killed, standing with a woman and a boy, probably his wife and young son. They all looked serious, the way people often did in old American photos, but the man had his hands on the shoulders of his wife and son. He loved them, wanted to keep them safe, wanted to protect them from American devils like Ray. Ray took the picture out of the wallet and put it in his pocket. Ray would keep the photo, carry it with him, keep this man and his family alive in a way. It felt like the right thing to do.
Hideki. How to surrender. Hideki cried as he ran. The forest around him blurred, but he kept running, stumbling blindly through the undergrowth. No matter how far he ran, he couldn't escape his memories of what had happened. The whizzing bullets, the exploding grenades. Takashi killing himself, Gensei, Katsumasa, all the other boys, dead. He didn't want to think it, didn't want to see it, but he couldn't stop seeing it. The images flashed in his mind faster than he could handle them. Hideki tripped and fell, scraping his elbows. Heart in his throat, he felt for the ceramic grenades in his pocket, but neither of them had broken. As he got to his hands and knees, he saw that he'd tripped over a log. No, not a log, he realized. A body. He scrambled away from it, his heart racing, until he backed into a blasted tree stump. He was about to get up, to keep running, when he recognized the shape of the person through his tears.
Principal Kojima?
Hideki asked. He sniffed and dragged his dirty sleeve across his eyes. The principal still clutched the sack full of pictures of the emperor, but now he lay next to the sack, hugging it like a pillow. Hideki approached slowly, cautiously, as though Principal Kojima might pop up and begin scolding him for speaking Okinawan and not Japanese. But Principal Kojima was dead, killed by the blast from an artillery shell. His face looked more concerned than pained. Even in death, he was still worrying about protecting the emperor's pictures. Hideki pulled out one of the pictures and looked at it. His Majesty the Emperor was a young man, with a long nose, short mustache, and round, frameless glasses. He wore a ceremonial military uniform with fancy braids on the shoulders and arms, a silk sash across the front, and so many medals that they filled the whole front of the jacket. Hideki felt a swell of pride for his country. Principal Kojima had been doing a brave thing protecting His Majesty's Mabui. Maybe Hideki could make up for his own cowardice by taking over this sacred duty and seeing the photographs to safety. Hideki repacked the photographs in the bag and found that Principal Kojima had a bit of bread and a sock full of rice tucked away, too. That would come in handy. An airplane roared overhead, and Hideki looked up. It wasn't a kamikaze. It was an American plane, and it was dropping something. Hideki threw himself on the sack to protect it from the falling bombs. He put his hands over his head and clenched, waiting for the booms. But they didn't come. He heard a soft rustling instead. Hideki looked up to see thousands of white pieces of paper fluttering to the ground like the cherry blossoms that fell from the sakura trees every spring. The Americans were dropping paper? Hideki caught a piece of paper and looked at it. It had Japanese writing on it. How to surrender, it said in big, bold letters, and after that, it explained how the Okinawans should approach American soldiers if they wanted to give themselves up and be protected. To make it clear you were surrendering, the leaflet said, you should stay away from the Japanese army, Leave the combat area immediately and wear something white, if possible. Surrender. Hideki crumpled up the leaflet and threw it to the ground. It was like the Americans knew he was a coward and were teasing him about it. He wasn't going to surrender, and he wasn't going to let the Americans or Shigatomo's Mabui tell him what to do. Almost in response, the American battleships began to range in on his location. Kathoom! 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 The bombs were getting closer every second. Hideki quickly hefted the sack onto his shoulders. He had to get away from here, but where? Hideki's mind went to the safest place he could think of, his haka, his family's tomb. Yes, it wasn't far. Hideki put his head down and ran through the falling bombs, zigging and zagging so they couldn't catch him. When he was clear of the artillery, he kept running, past the crater-filled rice paddies and burned-down farmhouses outside his village. He had been to his family tomb so many times in his life, he knew the way by heart. The Kaneshiro's haka was where they buried their dead. It was where they came to worship and celebrate them, too. Going back to it felt like going home, in a way, and gave Hideki a new sense of confidence and purpose. 3 times a year, Hideki helped his father clean the tomb. Eventually, the job would be his, until he could share the duty with his own firstborn son. Where was his father now? Hideki wondered. Was he alive? Was he dead? He might never know. As he rounded the last turn to his family tomb, Hideki worried that it might not be there anymore, that an American bomb might have blasted it and all of Hideki's ancestors to bits. But there it was, just as it had always been, and his heart soared. The Kaneshiro haka was built into a hill and had a big round roof that resembled a giant turtle shell. Family name markers sat in the courtyard outside. The small door to the tomb was fronted by a narrow porch with a railing. If he looked through the frame of his fingers, Hideki could see the porch as it had been before. His extended family gathered to make their annual offerings of incense, food, and rice liquor to their ancestors and share the happy feast with the spirits. It was one of the days Hideki most looked forward to, but they had missed it this year. Everyone had been relocated by the Japanese army, or was too busy working for them. Or both. The most recent time he'd been back here was with Kimiko. He and his sister had come over the winter to repeat the ritual they hoped would finally bring peace to Shigatomo and free Hideki from the influence of his ancestors' Mabui. Kimiko had noticed that Hideki was moving stiffly as they prepared the incense and offerings for the ceremony, and she pulled back the sleeve of his shirt to reveal the bruises on his arm he'd been trying to hide.
"Who did this to you?" Kimiko demanded.
Hideki looked at the floor.
"Yoshio," he said, "a boy at school. Did you at least fight back?"
Kimiko asked.
"No. Yoshio would have beaten me up."
Kimiko smacked Hideki in the head.
"He did beat you up, and he'll keep doing it until you stand up to him." "It's Shigatomo's fault," Hideki told her. "He makes me scared."
Kimiko shook her head.
"It's not about being scared," she told him. "It's about doing what you have to do, even though you're scared."
She yanked Hideki's sleeve back down to hide his bruises again. She was still frowning, but her tone softened.
"If he does it again, come and get me and I'll beat him up."
Hideki could never do that. Let his sister fight bullies for him? The boys at school would never let him live that down. But he still hadn't stood up to Yoshio either. Kimiko just didn't understand. Hideki crawled inside the dark tomb just as it began to rain outside. He suddenly realized he might not be the first person to think of hiding out here, and he called out in Japanese.
"Hello? Is anyone here?"
He repeated his question in Okinawan, despite his fears that someone Japanese might overhear him and punish him for speaking his native language. When the Japanese had taken over Okinawa all those years ago, they'd made it illegal for the Okinawans to speak their own language or practice their own religion.
"Hideki,"
said a weak voice, and Hideki froze. Goosebumps crawled up and down his arms. Were his ancestors speaking to him? Was this the voice of Shigatomo, the ancestor whose Mabui he carried?
Hideki, is that you?
The voice croaked again. It was an ancestor, Hideki realized with a start, but not one nearly so old as Shigatomo.
Otto!
Hideki cried. It was his father.
Ray. Fire in the hole. I'm coming out, Ray called. He didn't want his rifle squad to shoot him as he exited the little Okinawan tomb. Sergeant Meredith, Big John, and the others waited outside, rifles at the ready, as Ray ducked through the doorway. Rain poured down on Ray like he was standing under the well pump back home. He leaned against the outside of the tomb, trying not to lose his breakfast.
Empty?
Big John asked. It is now, Ray said. After a Marine had chucked a grenade inside the tomb, Sergeant Meredith had sent Ray inside to see if there was anyone still alive. There wasn't. Not anymore. There had been. An Okinawan family had been hiding among the ceramic pots that held their ancestors, but they were gone now. The grenade had destroyed both the living and the dead. Ray put the back of his hand to his mouth, but he wasn't going to be sick. As horrible as it was in there, he'd seen worse already. God help me, I'm getting used to it, Ray thought. Just like Big John had said, but Ray didn't want to get used to it. That was how you became heartless like Big John, or stared off into the distance like the old man, or like Ray's father. Ray didn't ever want sights like this to sit easy with him.
Let's move out, Sergeant Meredith told his squad.
Sergeant, wait, Ray said. That tomb, it was full of Okinawans, women and children. We gotta stop using grenades on them.
But the last tomb was full of Japs, Big John reminded him. They had built a machine gun nest into it.
I know, but sometimes there's innocent people in there, Ray argued. We should at least be using smoke grenades on them. That won't kill them, just flush them out.
Yeah, flush them out shooting, said Big John.
Dang it, Majors, that's just what the Japs want us to do, said Private First Class Brown, a rifleman from another squad. Sergeant Meredith grabbed PFC Brown by the poncho and slammed him up against the stone wall of the tomb.
You don't ever call that boy by his last name again, the sergeant barked. Do you understand me, Private?
Sergeant Meredith thrust Brown up against the tomb once more, knocking loose his helmet. Rain poured down on the private's head as he nodded, his eyes scared. Sergeant Meredith turned on the rest of the squad, and they all took a step back.
It's Ray or it's barbecue, but never Majors, do you understand me? The next joker who says it gets nicknamed General.
Another Marine snorted at the idea of a death wish for a nickname, and Sergeant Meredith let go of Brown and glared at him.
You think I'm kidding?
Everybody found somewhere else to look.
We use smoke grenades on the tombs from here on out, Sergeant Meredith told them. We don't none of us wear this uniform because it's easy.
There was some grumbling at the decision, but Sergeant Meredith was the boss. He gave them 15 minutes before they had to head out again, and Ray found a place to be alone. The sergeant had yelled at everybody on his behalf, and Ray was the reason they couldn't chuck frag grenades in tombs anymore. Ray wasn't the most popular guy in the squad right now, and he could feel it. Ray found shelter under a palm frond and took the pictures he'd collected out of his pack. After he'd taken the first photograph from the man he'd killed with his rifle, it had become something Ray did after every encounter. Now he had pictures of families, pictures of sweethearts, pictures of houses and pets and parents. They weren't all from Japanese soldiers he'd killed himself, but a lot of them were.
Why do you keep all them things?
Big John asked, making Ray jump. He hadn't heard him come up.
I don't know, Ray said. Don't you wonder about these people? Who they are? Where they come from? Why they're here? I know why they're here, Big John said. They're here to kill me.
I'm sorry, Ray said, about the smoke grenades. He knew his request would be the least popular with his own foxhole buddy. Big John just shrugged.
Like the sergeant said, we ain't Marines 'cause it's easy.
He grinned.
Should have nicknamed you Soft Spot. Come on, barbecue. Time to move out.
Hopefully this dang rain will let up soon. The squad gathered near Sergeant Meredith, and they were all about to move out when they heard a distinctive pop. Everyone froze. After several days on Okinawa, Ray knew exactly what that sound meant. They all did.
"Grenade!" Big John cried. "Hit the deck!"
But where? Who? Ray was about to throw himself into the mud when he caught Sergeant Meredith's wide, horror-filled eyes. Ray suddenly understood, and the bottom dropped out of his world. One of the grenades in the sergeant's belt pouch had activated by accident, and it was going to explode in less than 5 seconds.
Hideki. Suteishi.
Oto!
Hideki cried. As Hideki's eyes adjusted to the darkness inside his family tomb, he saw his father lying propped up against the stone caskets in the corner. Along the back wall of the tomb ran the shelves of urns that held the bones of his ancestors from generations past, including Shigetomo's. A wide streak of blood trailed from the entrance of the tomb to Hideki's father, and Hideki's heart lurched.
Oto, you're hurt!
Hideki dropped the bag of the Emperor's photos by the door and ran to his father. Oto's breathing was ragged, and he slumped unnaturally to the side. One arm laid across his uniform jacket. Hideki lifted his father's hand away and saw a jagged wound in his stomach. His father had taken shrapnel from a grenade.
"A little run-in with the Americans," Oto said. "We have to get you to a doctor," Hideki cried. "It's all right, Hideki. Someone is on the way,"
his father promised him.
"But I could use some water."
Hideki grabbed an empty pot and ran through the rain to a nearby spring like it was the most important thing in the world. When he returned, he had to tip the pot to Oto's mouth for him. His father wasn't strong enough to hold it himself.
"You need the doctor," Hideki told his father. "I should go and find him."
Oto grabbed Hideki's arm with more strength than Hideki thought he had.
"No. Don't go. I want you to clean the tomb while we wait." "Clean the tomb?" Hideki said. "That doesn't matter right now." "It always matters," Oto told him.
He closed his eyes.
"And make an offering. It's been too long."
Hideki didn't want to leave his father's side, but he did as he was told. The haka was dusty and full of cobwebs. In the past, they would never have let the family tomb become so untidy. But like their annual family picnic, the cleaning of the tomb had been set aside in their preparations for war. Failing to look after a haka brought sickness and death to a family, so cleaning it was doing something to help his father. At least, that's what Hideki told himself. He found a broom and hastily swept the floor and shelves. When he was finished, he took half the rice from the sock in Principal Kojima's bag and put it into a small stone bowl as an offering to Shigetomo and the rest of his ancestors. It wasn't as much as Hideki and his father usually left, but his ancestors had gone too long without any kind of offering, and it was as much as Hideki could spare.
"What's in the sack?"
his father asked.
"Pictures of His Majesty the Emperor," Hideki said. "I'm keeping them safe."
His father closed his eyes again and shook his head.
"No, Hideki. Forget about those things. You need to find your sister instead. She's all we have left."
"What do you mean?"
"Hideki, your mother and brother, they're dead."
Hideki's head spun. He couldn't believe what he was hearing.
"But no. No. They were evacuated to mainland Japan. They're safe."
His father shook his head.
"Their ship was torpedoed by an American submarine,"
Oto said.
"No one on board survived."
Hideki sat down on the cold floor of the family tomb. Shock washed over him like a wave. It couldn't be true.
"No. I would have heard,"
Hideki said.
At school, they would have told us.
The Japanese army forbade anyone to talk about it. It was bad for morale. But it's true, Hideki. I was at headquarters when the news came in. The ship was sunk the day after it left Naha Harbor. They stopped the evacuations after that.
Hideki reeled. He had almost been aboard that ship. If he hadn't decided to stay and fight, he'd be dead now too. His eyes fell on a cobweb he'd missed in his haste, and he felt sick to his stomach. Hideki had always resented having to clean the family tomb, but now he saw what disaster neglecting it could bring.
I should never have sent them away,
Otto said.
And I should never have let the IJA have you and your sister. You're both going to die with the Japanese.
Hideki saw again in his mind's eye the awful carnage of the Blood and Iron Student Corps' failed attack on the Americans. It was hard not to agree with his father. But he and his classmates were just students, boys. Surely the Imperial Japanese Army would fare better than the Blood and Iron Student Corps had against the invaders.
No,
Hideki said.
We have to win.
Otto shook his head again.
Hideki, the Japanese were never going to win this fight. They knew that from the start. The generals withdrew the very best soldiers from Okinawa long ago and sent them to Taiwan. They didn't want them to die here with the rest of us. We're just here to slow the Americans down while the army sets up their real defenses on the mainland. We're a suteishi in Go. A sacrificial pawn.
Go was an ancient game from China with black and white stones, where the object was to capture as much territory as possible. Sometimes you had to play a stone you knew was going to get taken, but you did it to make your opponent play a stone that would hurt them later. But the Okinawans weren't stones to be won or lost. They were real people. Hideki couldn't believe the emperor would just throw their lives away like that.
But the Yamato,
Hideki argued,
they wouldn't send the biggest battleship in the Japanese fleet if they thought...
The Yamato was sunk by American planes 3 weeks before it was supposed to get here,
his father said.
No one... He's coming to save us, Hideki. That's why you have to save yourself and your sister.
Hideki's father coughed up blood. Where was that doctor? No one is coming to save us, Hideki. That's what his father had said. What if Otto had been lying about a doctor coming to help him?
Otto,
Hideki began. But suddenly, he heard someone coming through the entrance of the tomb. The doctor. At last. But, as the shadow emerged from the doorway, Hideki saw it wasn't a doctor after all. It was a soldier.
Ray. Crying in the rain.
Grenade! Grenade, get down!
Big John yelled. Ray dropped flat to the ground. Sergeant Meredith took 2 running steps from everybody else, unhooked his grenade pouch, and chucked it away as hard as he could. Ray had just enough time to scream, "Sergeant!" before, boom! The pouch exploded, and the sergeant was thrown back against the outside of the tomb like a rag doll. Mud and bits of shrapnel peppered Ray's helmet, but he wasn't hurt. Big John looked up from the muck.
"What the hell just happened?"
"Sergeant Meredith!" Ray cried. He was up and on his feet and slipping toward the sergeant before anyone else. "It was one of his grenades," Ray told the others. "In his pouch. One of the pins must have got caught on something and worked its way out." Sergeant Meredith had tried to twist away from the blast, but but one whole side of him was torn up. He was still alive, though.
"Somebody get on the radio and call for a medic," the old man said.
"No time," Big John said. He pushed his heavy rifle into Ray's hands, and with one great heave, Big John picked up Sergeant Meredith and threw him onto his shoulder.
"He's not going to die here. Not like this,"
Big John told them, and he took off for camp at a run. Ray and the others ran with him. Sergeant Meredith hung over Big John's shoulder, his unconscious face turned to the side facing Ray. Sergeant Meredith was the one who'd taught him how to survive. Sergeant Meredith was the one who'd given him his nickname. Sergeant Meredith was the one who had listened when Ray had argued for the Okinawans. Sergeant Meredith was the one who had taught Ray how to grieve for the death of a soldier. Ray just hoped he wasn't going to have to grieve for Sergeant Meredith. Back at camp, the medics whisked Sergeant Meredith away. Ray and his squad waited on pins and needles for word on the sergeant's condition. News of a death finally came that day, but it wasn't Sergeant Meredith. It was Franklin D. Roosevelt, the President of the United States, had died of a stroke. Ray sat down on his helmet, stunned. Roosevelt had been President of the United States since Ray was 6 years old. FDR had led America into war after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor in 1941. Less than a year ago, he'd been re-elected to a fourth term, which had never happened before with any U.S. president. Roosevelt was well-liked and respected among the Marines. A lot of them around the camp were shaken up by the news, and Ray saw one or two of them crying. Ray felt more shocked than anything.
"It's Jap propaganda," Gonzalez said. "It has to be."
"No, it came in over the radio from the ships offshore," a captain told them. "It's real."
"Who's in charge now, Vice President Truman?" Gonzalez asked. "What do you think he'll be like?"
"Doesn't matter," Big John said sourly. "Losing the sergeant means more than losing some politician off in Washington. The president dying don't change a dang thing for any of us on Okinawa."
"We don't know the sergeant is dead yet," Ray argued.
"No, but you saw him. Even if he lives, he's not coming back. After all those battles he lived through, to go out like that."
Big John shook his head.
"Still doesn't mean we can't be sad about the president," the old man said, but Big John just shrugged.
"Grenade!"
Someone yelled, and suddenly a live grenade plopped into the muck at their feet.
"What? How?"
Ray thought. But before he or anyone else could leap away or drop flat, the grenade went off with an ear-splitting bang. Ray jumped out of his skin, and some of the other guys screamed. But the grenade hadn't exploded. The top had blown off it, but its iron pineapple shell was still intact. Ray staggered back. He didn't understand what was going on. One of the recent replacement troops, Private Wilbert Zimmer, guffawed nearby.
"I thought I shook all the powder out, but I guess there was a little left in there after all," he crowed.
But he was the only one laughing. The grenade had just been a prank. Ray felt like he almost had a heart attack. He put a hand on a tree to steady himself. Big John bellowed with rage and charged Zimmer, tackling him hard. Big John battered the private with his big, powerful fists until Ray and the old man and three others could finally pull him off. Private Zimmer's face was purple, and his eyes were swelling shut.
"I was only joking," he blubbered. "Nobody got hurt."
"Sergeant Meredith was nearly killed by a grenade today, you idiot," Gonzalez told him.
"I didn't know," Zimmer said. "I didn't know."
Ray woke to relieve Big John on second watch late that night. The rain was still pouring down, like heaven was crying.